Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for joining me for this latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. It's supported by great subscribers, including Leanne Rayer, Joan Falber, John Collins, and Gael Lagar in France. If you'd like to join that group, just log on to peterbcollins.com. And you can subscribe for as little as $5 a month. Coming up later in this podcast, Mr. No Nukes returns. Harvey Wasserman, the author of Solartopia, is about ready to take a victory lap in celebration of the impending shutdown of the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. But first, here's a guy that I should have been talking with for years, because people have been telling me about Professor Rick Wolf from many different directions. You may have seen his excellent commentaries at truthout.org. I was first alerted to him by my original producer, Matt Renner, who helped me launch the Peter B. Collins Show into syndication way back there in 2005. And there are many other points of connectivity. The most recent one was last week at a political event in California. I saw Jeff Cohen, who, of course, is one of the founders of the media activist group FAIR, and he teaches journalism. And he told me, well, I got to get back to New York because I'm on a panel with Rick Wolf. So, Professor, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And quick background for people who may not know, you've got a stack of degrees from Harvard, Stanford, Yale, topped out with a PhD in economics back in 1969. And you teach at the New School in New York City, where you're a visiting professor currently. And you also teach at the Brecht Forum in Manhattan. You've got a radio show weekly on WBAI, the Pacifica program in New York. Anything else you think people ought to know about?
Well, on May 1st of this year, people in California might be interested particularly. A book is coming out, published by City Lights Books in San Francisco, called Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. And it's a in-depth look via interviews conducted with me by the journalist David Barsamian. And people will find it interesting.
Barsamian is great. And your most recent book that I have is Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It.
Yes, that was my kind of opening gambit in trying to meet the need that I felt coming from so many people that I encountered, wanted a kind of understandable explanation and interpretation of how the American economy got itself into such a mess that would hurt so many people and now lasting into its fifth year. This was an attempt to kind of meet that demand.
Now, isn't the book irrelevant at this point? Because we all know, I watched Mitt Romney on television last night, Barack Obama is single-handedly responsible for our economic problems. It all started when he was elected.
Yes. It is amazing how American politics works. It's almost as though somebody had programmed Americans so that every time there's an economic problem or crisis, whether it's a plant shutting down or prices zooming up or whatever it is, we always as a nation seem to do something peculiar. We don't get angry at the actual people who do the damage to us.
Yeah.
For example, we lose our jobs. Over the last 5 years, roughly 8 to 9 million people lost their jobs, were fired. The overwhelming majority, in excess of 90% of those people, were fired by a private employer. Do we see a big upsurge of American anger at private employers for doing such a hurtful thing to all those people? No. We jump right over the private employer and blame the government. Likewise, over 90% of the people thrown out of their homes rendered homeless through the foreclosure. Those foreclosures are legal procedures initiated mostly by private banks. And do we get angry at the private bank? No. We jump right over them and again blame the politicians. And they all do it to each other. You know, President Obama, to be fair, came into office in 2008 because he effectively linked the Republicans and George Bush, the president then, to the terrible crisis that was just sweeping across the nation. And I suspect the Republicans are gleefully trying to do the same thing back to him. It's a little silly. The president of the United States that does not have all that much economic power, to blame him all the time not only misses who the real problems, where the problems really come from, but ends up reinforcing this sad tendency of Americans to think that they ought to blame politicians, probably because they're afraid to confront who the problem really is.
Well, I take your point, Professor, and I would underscore it by adding that I believe that when Obama became president, one of his early failures was to really instruct or educate the American people on the cause of our economic problems. And by being too kind to Bush, by being too kind to his Republican predecessors in general, and the policies that really took us to the brink of a huge disaster. And for the people who lost their jobs and have lost their homes, it wasn't the brink. It took them over the edge. But as Obama came in with all of this post-partisanship bullshit, he really lost the opportunity to get people to understand that he was trying to clean up a mess. And I'm one of those people who believe that the stimulus was too small and also was riddled with tax cuts for that were generally meaningless in terms of stimulating the economy. They were intended to buy Republican votes that never materialized. And by keeping Summers and Geithner bringing them in who really were related to the source of these problems, he compounded this by boxing himself in.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember sitting there in disbelief. I mean, I didn't expect all that much from Mr. Obama, to be honest, but nonetheless, to see him bring in with him Larry Summers, Geithner, and a whole raft of these other people required a blindness to what had happened. I mean, these were the people in charge when everything went bad. These were the people in charge when President Bush, early when the crisis was just building, promised everyone it wouldn't be a problem. These were the people who announced publicly that you didn't have to worry about subprime mortgages because that was a small, isolated part of the market and nothing would spread to the larger economy. And then when finally the recession was upon us, these were the people who kept promising us it would last a short time. It would be a V-shaped downturn, you know, one that goes down quickly but comes back up quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things should have disqualified them. And the whole parade of them should more than have disqualified them from having any role whatsoever since they had proven their inability to understand, let alone cope with what was going on.
And, Professor, given that, when somebody like Mitt Romney addresses an amnesia-riddled partisan Republican group and informs them that it's regulation that is the problem and that Obama has regulated corporate America to death, I just want to puke because the Dodd-Frank bill has a couple of good elements but is 10% of the strength of what we needed to re-regulate the financial industries in this country. And now we have this new phony Jobs Act that sailed through the House with quite a bit of Democratic support, and it would permit telephone boiler rooms to take advantage of little people, through investment scams. It really is not any kind of a fix to the problems that we have encountered over the last 5 years. And yet, Romney can get away with this because Obama really failed to properly define the problems that he was attempting to solve.
Yeah, I think Obama seems to have been very afraid that even talking about the problems of our economy, let alone confronting them, would be so unpopular with corporations and banks that they would in turn turn against him. And it's been a very sad kind of a story. That jobs bill, which is scheduled to pass, I believe, this week, taking away, reducing some of the little bit of regulation that has actually been added. I mean, Americans should remember that we have fundamentally been through 30 years of deregulation, capped with the end of what was called the Glass-Steagall Act, the act to control banking that came out of the last great collapse of capitalism in the 1930s. That was finally repealed late in the 1990s, and literally 8 years after the repeal of limits on the banks, it turns out the banks had run crazy with the limit of with the end of that regulation, and made all the kinds of imprudent, overly risky investments with other people's deposits that brought us into the crisis. It's literally like, you know, the famous stories about having a young person who's from a very sheltered home finally go to college with the rules no longer there and mom and pop no longer in a position to enforce them, and having to kind of go crazy for a while before they get back down to reality. We should learn from the lessons of the past and not reproduce this. I'll give you just one more example, because it really boggles the mind. We had an extended period of many months in America talking about our banks were so big that they were, quote, too big to fail. And so the government had to come in and bail them out with trillions of dollars of government money and of public money. And so we had to urgently deal with that problem. If you look at the top 20 banks in the United States today, every one of them is either the same size or bigger than it was in 2007 when this crisis hit. That's not a sign of government regulation. That's a sign of the government doing absolutely nothing to prevent the reproduction of the conditions that brought us this crisis in the first place.
And, Professor, I'm just going to stick my neck out here and bet a nickel that you either know or have been in contact with Bill Black. He teaches at in Kansas City, and he was a savings and loan regulator during the 1980s. Do you know about him?
Yes, I do.
Well, Bill has been very outspoken in particularly the last year in pointing out that the savings and loan scandal cost the United States taxpayers about $150 billion, but 10,000 criminal referrals surfaced and more than 1,000 felony convictions were won. But the Obama administration, despite the recent flurry of press releases about crackdown on most recent mortgage fraud problems with the robo-signing and the denial of workouts and those sorts of things, has missed a huge opportunity, once again, to educate the American public and Wall Street about the need for sensible regulation. And by allowing the Justice Department, and I won't draw you into my other politics about Guantanamo and torture and war crimes that this president has said he's too busy looking forward to prosecute. But on the narrow question of financial crimes, this administration and the committees, the oversight committees of Congress, have been missing in action from the start.
Yeah, my suspicion is, and I suspect that Black would agree with me, but in any case, my suspicion is the following. Partly this is political, that is, you don't prosecute these people because you don't want them to become a big loud force to keep you quiet, to fight against you and to denounce you. You know that they can at any time be prosecuted, so if you don't go after them, they keep a very low profile and keep their mouths shut, etc. I understand all that, but I think there's another argument here. I think that if you open the can of worms of beginning to look at all the things that the financial sector did that either cross the line of legality or come so close to it that even if they don't break the law, they have violated the spirit of that law, there's no end to what you can find. I mean, basically, what we have had is a financial system that figured out every conceivable way to to get around the law, to avoid the law, whether it's opening subsidiaries in other parts of the world where the laws are different, or hiding what they do here, or setting up dummy corporations, banks, and other kinds of things to get around the rules. We've seen enough to know that if you began, even with only a handful of the biggest criminal behavior, you're opening a process that could end up drawing the entire financial network, and even there it might not stop. I mean, we have an economic system that rewards people for cutting costs, cutting corners, making a quick buck, being the head of the corporation for a few years, which is as long as most of them last, where you want everything to look like you're making a profit. Once you're gone, have your big CEO pay package safely tucked away.
Yep.
If the disaster happens, that's the problem of your successor, not of yourself. I mean, we have a built-in system that in 101 ways takes everybody, even the well-intentioned and the otherwise honest, into a land of, at best, shady dealing. And I think that the fear that all of that kind of thing will be uncovered and exposed is what leads politicians, often wrapped up in these activities themselves, to basically come up with lines like, I want to look forward rather than backward.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor, some of the elements you just described approach what I wanted to raise next, which is Apple Computer sitting on $100 billion in cash, and that's one-tenth or slightly less of the estimated total amount of cash that corporate America is sitting on. And it, to the credit of Tim Cook, who replaced St. Steve Jobs after he died, Apple has been a little bit more transparent about the manufacturing network it has in China, about its relationship with Foxconn in particular. And this week, Apple announced that it is going to do a stock buyback and for the first time start to pay quarterly dividends with the capital that it has amassed. And those are both reasonable moves. I don't have any great criticism. But they are funding that from money that is onshore, and it's clear that they are going to maintain the bulk of their accrued cash offshore and use it as a club over the U.S. government, saying that we will not repatriate this money until you lower the corporate tax that we don't pay anyway. And when I look at this picture, and I'm an Apple partisan, I'm looking at an Apple computer screen, I've got all the toys, I like their products. I think that their corporate model sucks, and I think that there's a teachable moment here that, once again, Barack Obama will pass on.
Absolutely. I mean, let's be real clear, and I'm going to put on my hat as a professional economist. One of the reasons Apple is as profitable as it has been is precisely that it moved its production, virtually all of its production, over to a place where people are paid incredibly low wages. One of the reasons they're a bit more transparent is they got kind of outed about the conditions in many of their factories or the factories of their providers or the companies they subcontract to in China. It was a real scandal both there and here. But what they make money off of is paying workers next to nothing to produce a product which they bring back to the United States and sell at quite a hefty price, quite a premium over regular PCs, as we all know, and they amass a very enormous profit. But look at what that means. You're concentrating those profits in the hands of shareholders. The shareholders, as a percentage of the American population, Apple shareholders, is a tiny, tiny, tiny percent. 1%, maybe 2%, no more than that, is in the American population. You've deprived God knows how many Americans of jobs and of all the economic benefits that flow from having jobs in this country to make more money by Apple, which it then funnels as stock buybacks and dividend payoffs to a tiny handful of people, the vast majority of which are already rich, otherwise they wouldn't be in a position to have significant amounts of Apple shares. So when all is said and done, this is a massive project of moving wealth out of the hands of Americans laid off from decent-paying union jobs replaced by desperately poor Chinese workers, all of which benefits rich people in the United States who are already in the top 1 or 2% of the population. This is not anything other than, if you will allow me the phrase, class war, but it's class war on the ground in real dollar terms rather than the rhetorical flourishes that people usually call class war.
I'm not at all offended by the term. I believe that we've lost the class war.
Right.
and that those who deplore it in political rhetoric are the ones who are thrilled at how much ground they have grabbed at our expense. And Professor, just one other aspect of the Apple gambit here. My own senator from California, Senator Boxer, who's generally progressive, has been an apologist for Silicon Valley and has overlooked backdating of stock options, which occurred at Apple and many other Valley companies. And she also has been a promoter of the tax holiday in an attempt to get these profits held overseas to be brought home. And the argument is, well, this is going to create jobs in the United States. Could you address that?
Yes, I mean, that's simply not true. And if a student in any economics professor's class that I know of were simply to make a comment like that, say in writing an answer to an exam question, that if you cut taxes, you create jobs, that student would get a zero on that answer. That's simply not true. If you cut the taxes on corporations, all it means is money that they otherwise would have paid to the government in a tax is no longer going to have to be paid. You've cut that tax, you've reduced it, you've eliminated it. Now the question is, what is the government, what is the corporation, or for that matter, the individual who enjoys a tax cut, what is he or she going to do with the money they no longer pay in taxes? It's possible they will use it to hire people and create jobs, but in a quote-unquote free enterprise system, they are precisely free not to do that, which is why cutting a tax is not the same thing as creating jobs or anything like it. And indeed, we know in recent years, when taxes have been cut, corporations have decided, A, that the economy looks so poor that they're not going to be so stupid as to hire people to produce more of what they're already having trouble selling. So instead of taking their tax cuts and hiring people, they lend that money, for example, to Uncle Sam, since he's borrowing to beat the band. Or, secondarily, even if they took the tax savings from a cut tax and used it to invest in jobs, you can bet your bottom dollar that the high likelihood they will hire people where the wages are cheapest, which is not here. They'll hire people in China or India or Bangladesh or Latin America or wherever it is, so that even if jobs are created, and there's no guarantee of it, they will not necessarily be created in the United States. And for the last 25 years, the bulk of hiring by American companies has been outside the United States, not here. For such reasons, the rhetorical flourish of conservatives, which takes even the nervy suggestion that cutting taxes is job creation, is not only bad political misleading, but it is economic nonsense.
Professor Wolf, you're variously described as a Marxist and as a Marxian. And I wonder if you would share with us the distinction between those terms. And coupled with that, has Karl Marx correctly predicted the implosion of the capitalist system?
Well, it's a great question. Let me try to, in a brief span, answer it. Karl Marx, who lived in the 19th century, was born and died in that century, is and remains the most profound, developed critic of the capitalist system, which is what he devoted his life work to. He never wrote a book on communism. He never wrote a book on socialism. He felt those would be things that come in the future, and he said once in a joke to a press reporter, I'm not in the business of predicting the future. Nobody can do that. So he was an analyst of capitalism, but what made him different from Adam Smith and David Ricardo, the great founders of modern economics who liked capitalism, was the fact that he was a critic, and he made no bones about it. He was very clear about it. He basically thought the world could do better than capitalism, and he was going to set out to show everybody how capitalism worked in such a way that they would see the validity of his view. Now, my feeling has always been if you want to understand capitalism, you have to proceed the way you would, for example, if you wanted to understand a family that lived across the street from you. Suppose you knew that that family had a mama and a papa and two kids, and one of the kids thought it was the greatest family in the world, and the other kid was critical of his or her parents for whatever reason. If you wanted to get to know the family, the logical thing would be to talk to both of the children and then draw whatever conclusions you think are appropriate from what each of them has said. Likewise, if you want to understand capitalism, then by all means, study the works of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and a whole list of people who thought capitalism was wonderful. But also expose yourself and consider the analytics of people who thought it was flawed as a system, who thought you could do better, who were critics. I thought that made sense, so I went and learned what Marx had to say. And that has led people to be looking at me funny over my lifetime, although in the last few years much less so, not because there's anything wrong with the logic of what I say or anything wrong with the Marxian theory, which frankly most Americans don't know much about, but because it had become taboo. It had become a kind of a thing you're not supposed to talk about in polite company.
That's right.
So,
you're a commie.
Like sex or something like that. And my final point here is simply that, you know, we as Americans are kind of proud that we debate and discuss our education system, our medical insurance system, our transportation system. But one thing for the last 50 years has been taboo. We don't dare argue about, debate our economic system. There, everybody's supposed to fall all over themselves being a cheerleader or a booster. We haven't had for 50 years a serious debate in this country about the pros and cons of our economic system. And you know something? If you don't criticize the system you've got, it starts to rot on you. And I think we're living in a capitalist system that has had a pass for 50 years when it didn't deserve one, and that we're slowly and painfully catching up to the need to criticize a system that clearly isn't working very well.
And Professor, isn't it ironic that the one moment of critical commentary about capitalism that I can recall from the past year surfaced when a crackpot governor from Texas was desperate to take on the king of Bain Capital, Mitt Romney.
Right.
And in South Carolina, for a moment, he told the truth about vulture capitalism, about the way Bain was a company that would take over and dismantle a company, lay off its workers, and pocket fat fees. And that was breathtaking, wasn't it?
Right, and you could see that the man lost all the business support, all the big money, that was the only way he got in the first place. Anyway, all of that decided, don't need this anymore.
Yeah.
And boy, he was gone. It reminded me of many years ago when Pat Robertson was trying to get the Republican nomination and started talking one day to a Wall Street Journal reporter about the Christian concept of jubilee, which is this idea that every 10 or 20 or 30 years you kind of reshuffle all the wealth of a society,
mm-hmm,
almost by lottery, so that people don't get stuck being rich or poor, that it's a kind of a Christian notion. Everybody starts off again kind of on a level playing field. And the day after Robertson made that remark, a whole raft of his support just literally fled for the doorways to get as far away from him as they possibly could. He had somehow said something which was so anathema to them, and we never heard of Pat Robertson again. He disappeared. I mean, he's still there, but he disappeared as a serious contender for any Republican job.
Yeah. Well, the result is something I don't have a problem with, but the process, I agree, is a little sordid. Professor, two more quick things.
Sure.
Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University has decided to challenge Lawrence Summers for the presidency of the World Bank, and we have not seen this before. It's usually an insider appointment, a plum that's given as a payoff, and I find this refreshing and unusual. First of all, what is your take on Sachs? And secondly, is this a meaningful challenge?
The second part of that question is a good one, but I'm not competent to answer. I don't know whether it is more than symbolic. I mean, I hope so, but I don't know. But as to the first part of your question, Jeffrey Sachs is an interesting character. Back in the 1990s, you could not have found a more gung-ho, pro-capitalist kind of guy anywhere in the community of economists or economic policy people in all the best universities, Harvard, Yale, and all the rest. He was a guy who believed that if you only establish capitalism anywhere, it's a one-way magic ticket to prosperity, economic growth, well-being for everybody, and 47 other wonderful things I might list if we had more time.
Uh-huh.
And he became famous for going to the ex-Soviet Union after the changes there,
right,
when it was called Russia, and being sent as a kind of guru of Western capitalism, who was going to bring the blessings of that capitalism that he believed so wholeheartedly in to a transition in Russia. And he administered something called, either depending on your language, a rapid transition program, or what came to be known in the press as shock therapy.
Right.
A kind of, you know, dropping you in ice cold water, suddenly converting public industries to private industries, suddenly converting decades old systems of distributing goods into a market mechanism, and so on. He did this for several years. At the end of that time, the new Russia was near collapse. He left Russia, hated by the people there pretty much universally for having helped plunge Russia into a level of misery that made the old Soviet Union look good by comparison. He came back to the United States, got that job at Columbia because he was well known, and the disaster he had left behind didn't seem to follow him except for people who knew. And then, and here comes the interesting part, then a kind of catharsis overtook him.
Mm-hmm.
He had one of those moments, I guess a moment of epiphany or whatever you call it, in which he, to his credit, he turned around and said that what he had done was a terrible mistake, that capitalism isn't a one-way ticket to growth and prosperity, that shock therapy was a mistake to have administered in the Soviet Union, and that he was now going to undertake a much more nuanced, much more balanced approach in which instituting capitalist institutions would not be the be-all and end-all of what had to be done, and so on. It was very unusual. He is one of three famous people who have done something like that. The other is Joseph Stiglitz,
right,
who was at the World Bank before.
Yeah.
And the third one is basically Paul Krugman, who appears so often in the New York Times and elsewhere, sort
right.
of today's number one Keynesian in the world economy. Each of them has a past of being more or less caught up in the neoliberal, uncritical celebration of capitalism. And each of them acquired very high positions as a result. And each of them has gone through a cathartic kind of reversion or reversal of their positions. You'd think for more Americans, looking at such high-profile characters go through such an experience, it would help, and it is, in fact, helping people to recognize that an uncritical, uninformed cheerleading for capitalism is really not the way to go or the justified approach. And I think that's part of the reason why people like me, who come at the thing from a more critical perspective, are having bigger and better audiences literally by the day.
Very interesting. And I agree with you on the catharsis point. And I'll just add, St. Paul had his on the way to Damascus, and that road's pretty dangerous these days.
Especially these days, yeah.
But Jeffrey Sachs, I met him last year when he was promoting his book, The Price of Civilization.
Right.
And I was loaded for bear. I was ready to talk about Russia and shock therapies. And he was totally disarming. And the book is very progressive.
That's right.
His critique of the American pay-for-play political system and how it influences economic decisions was right out there with any good lefty.
Right. I think he has been also affected, because I don't know him personally, but I know some of members of his family. I believe he has been affected also by the kinds of arguments you hear, for example, from Warren Buffett. That is, from people at the highest levels of America's corporate bureaucracy, among the wealthiest people on the planet, who look around American capitalism and are genuinely terrified, who believe that it is out of control, that it is driven now by people who simply imagine you can make the rich richer and the poor poorer for an indefinite period of time and to an unlimited degree. And they go around saying to people, and I think Jeffrey Sachs is one of those they've said it to, you better be very careful. You are killing the goose that has laid the golden eggs we've all accumulated. And in the end, you are going to destroy what it is you say you love because of your intemperate misunderstanding of the limits of what you're doing. And I think Jeffrey Sachs, in his own life, partly by that experience in Russia, has had to see the wisdom of that and the seriousness of the threat that it implies.
Well, and maybe if there is an actual campaign and there's real coverage, they will compare the speaking fees that Larry Summers took from Goldman Sachs and that Sachs hasn't been invited to Goldman Sachs to speak.
Exactly, and I think you'll see that Larry Summers has always been a weather vane. I mean, you can find out which way the prevailing winds are blowing by looking at what he's saying and what he's doing. And because he hasn't had yet the comeuppance that confronted the others one way or another, he hasn't. But let me tell you, things are changing in the graduate schools of economics across the United States. Each year now, the new incoming graduate students are not about to be told about a market being a perfect instrument that gets you an equilibrium that is maximally efficient and the professor starts talking like that, the visible agitation on the faces of the students who are coming out of a five-year crisis in the U.S., who've all been influenced by the Occupy Wall Street movement one way or another, they're not about to let the professor talk on like that. They don't have the space, these professors, that they had 3, 4, 5 years ago, let alone earlier, because the real world is coming into the classroom through the experienced lives of their students, and the turmoil in the classroom, which some of them have told me about, is going to be a vehicle to change them, just as the experience in Russia shook up Jeffrey Sachs.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Professor, my audience is far-flung. Hawaii, Montana, Florida, different parts of the world. And we're combined or connected by, I think, a sense of progressivism of left politics. So could you take a moment to dazzle my listeners with a quick report on the Left Forum that occurred in New York this past weekend? Because, you know, what passes for coverage of the left in this country is really just centrism. And I would really love to hear just a couple of highlights of the forum that you participated in.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Yes, before I even start, let me second what you had to say. The Left Forum is an annual event that gathers left-wing academics and left-wing activists across the board, people active on housing struggles or civil rights movement or Occupy Wall Street type things, academics who, like Jeffrey Sachs or others, are trying to change the way political science, economics, sociology, and so on are taught and understood. It does it every year in New York City, and it's been doing it for 30 years. And this one, the one that just ended this last weekend, was the most successful and the largest in the history of this effort. Something on the order of, we estimate now, but based on our registration, 4,600 people gathered, 4,600 people.
Mm-hmm.
There were over 420 panels during the 3 days of the weekend. Over 1,200 speakers addressed these 420 panels on every topic you can imagine: ecological questions of the environment, fracking, that Keystone Pipeline, all those kinds of issues that are important to people, every issue having to do with the medical establishment, health reform, things having to do with the Occupy Wall Street movement, things having to do with labor unions and the problems that they face, immigration, lots of panels about the problems of immigration from Latin America, from other places, you name it, on the left, basically across the board of things of social concern, they were being debated by a combination of scholars and activists. The entirety of something called Pace University, P PACE, mm-hmm. which is a business university, is given over to this. Hundreds of classrooms, huge auditoriums. On Saturday night, at a plenary session, the filmmaker Michael Moore addressed the collected people, people like Barbara Ehrenreich, Cornel West, Chris Hedges, Francis Fox Piven, a whole host of people who do this kind of work mm-hmm. were there either addressing plenaries or others. I would say approximately 85 publishers had purchased tables where they could show the books that they produced that might be of interest to the to this large crowd of people. And the whole thing takes place at Pace University across the street from the City Hall of New York City in Lower Manhattan. So it's a historic location, very exciting, lasts from about 6 o'clock Friday evening to about the same time Sunday evening. So a real long opportunity for people to immerse themselves as they'd like to. Huge numbers of young people. I think the Occupy Wall Street movement is accountable for that. Unbelievable that the New York Times, the leading newspaper in New York and arguably in the United States, didn't say a word about it. For them, nothing happened. Even though people came to this Left Forum from at least 25 countries around the world, and every single one of the 50 states was represented, in many cases by large delegations of people from those states. A truly important event, important historically because it's the biggest one, important because it has a sense of new renewal and confidence that there's a new left emerging in the United States. You'd think that any serious journalist would think it's something. And I'm not saying there were no journalists there. There mm-hmm. were quite yeah. a few, and particularly from abroad, with the irony associated with that, leading Japanese, French, German, British, you know, the Guardian in England covered it, and so on. And you can find lots of what happened there on the YouTube and so forth. But it was an amazing, and for many of those who went, a pretty inspiring thing. One other sign to your audience that may be interesting. One of the most interesting panels was presented by a group of activists from France. And what electrified the crowd in what they had to prepare, present, was what they called the changing political situation in their country. All the polls in France, they explained, now indicate, and they're pretty confident, that Mr. Sarkozy, who has been the president of France for quite a while, is about to be defeated. Mm. And he's about to be defeated by a man named François Hollande, H-O-L-L-A-N-D-E, who is the current leader of the French Socialist Party. And 2 weeks ago, they explained, Hollande went on national TV to explain to the French people, who now believe he is going to win because his lead in the polls is a double-digit lead, and at least in French history, no one who's ever been this far ahead, this close to the election is next month in April, has lost, which doesn't mean it can't happen, but nonetheless, it's remarkable. And even if he were to lose, the fact that an overwhelming majority of French people now want him and want Sarkozy out, since Sarkozy is running for re-election, mm-hmm. here's the interesting thing they explained to us. What's most famous about Hollande is his statement that France is not going to battle the economic crisis, because they have it there like we have it here, in the way that they used to. If the French people elect him, he said, the first thing he'll do is to stimulate an economy, but not by imposing austerity on the mass of people and not by borrowing more money to deepen the debt. That his approach is to tax corporations and the rich, and that mm-hmm. the first thing he'll do is raise the individual income tax on the highest bracket, the richest people, from its current 40% to a current 75%.
Wow.
And in the 3 days after he made that announcement, which was front page in all the media of France, his poll numbers went up. And it's a sign of where the mind of the French people is. They really are in no mood for any more austerity and in no mood to bail out large corporations. They have basically moved to a position where a clear majority of the French people think that the next phase of combating this crisis has to be led by the government and paid for by those who have done the best in French society over the last 30 years, and that is the larger corporations and the top 5 or 6% of the income earners in the society, and that's the position that a majority of French people support.
Well, that's quite encouraging, and I thank you for sharing that. Professor, I really appreciate your time today, and when your new book is out, I'd like to pre-invite you to come back and talk about it.
Perfect. I'll get City Lights to make sure you get a copy.
Richard D. Wolff, W-O-L-F-F, and your website is R.D. Wolff, right?
Right, rdwolff.com, and if you're interested, that's where all my writings, my videos, speeches, you name it, that's where it's posted, and it's all available at no charge.
Rick Wolff, nice to talk with you. Thank you,
sir. Nice to talk to you, and hope we do it again soon.
Senior No Nukes returns to our program today. The author of Solartopia, activist, historian, and for some reason, he's loyal to Columbus, Ohio. Harvey Wasserman returns to our program today. Hello, Harvey.
Yeah, great to be with you.
You ever think of escaping from Columbus?
Yes, all the time. And I do, periodically. So, dreams come true.
Yeah, and you go back because home is where the bills are.
Well, you know, there are plenty of advantages here as well, strangely enough. We have a wonderful bike path. I teach at two really good schools.
Mm-hmm.
Columbus is nothing if not convenient. It is the home of convenience, and so it's very easy to live here in many ways. It's reasonably cheap. It's flat, which is a bike rider. An elderly bike rider is good for me, and it has some other advantages.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm 15 minutes to the airport.
And what about solar there? Do you have a solar system at your house, and do you have enough sun to make it work?
No.
Yeah.
We do have south-facing windows. We put on an addition, and the windows face south. And we get a tremendous amount of heat gain from that, and that's
mm-hmm.
a big deal.
Yeah,
I don't have photovoltaics yet, although I just posted an article at nukefree.org, which I edit for Bonnie Rae Jackson Brown and Graham Nash,
mm-hmm.
about breakthroughs in photovoltaic cells with polymers, plastics, ironically.
Yeah,
and these may make it more economical for places like Columbus, Ohio to do solar.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I wanted to talk to you because you sent out a blast last week, and you're very optimistic that the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant is likely to be shut down in the near future.
Well, yes. And in fact, yesterday, or rather Monday, the Vermont Public Service Board voted to not grant a certificate of public good to the owner, Entergy, of Vermont Yankee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, technically, this should mean that the reactor should be shut, but of course, it's being appealed, and it's going into the courts and all that stuff. But the state of Vermont is very clear that they want this reactor shut. At this point in time, it's not even generating any power in Vermont. I mean, for Vermont, it's all going out of state.
Mm-hmm.
So Vermont has become a radioactive colony of the Entergy company.
Now, I want you to know, Vermont is the land of my ancestors. My grandfather came out of the Green Mountain State. And so I'm familiar with it. I've spent some time in Burlington and some of the other communities there. Tell us a little bit about the history of Vermont Yankee. How old is this plant? Is this a Fukushima-era construction, for example?
It is. It's a clone of Fukushima 1, which exploded. And it was opened in March 11th, 1972. So it's exactly 40 years it's been operating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the Certificate of Public Good and the licenses that go with it expired, March, I guess it was March 22nd, and why this is all coming to a head now. The state of Vermont's legislature, the Senate, voted 26-4 to shut Vermont Yankee, but a federal court said that the legislature did not have the power because of the preemption by the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, which put basically gave the nuclear power industry total sovereignty. It's really crazy, but a state does not have the legal power to shut a nuclear plant. And that's been a fairly consistent legal stone wall for the last, since 1954. But the Public Service Board of the state of Vermont does have the power to rescind the Certificate of Public Good. Now, this is important because Entergy bought Vermont Yankee in 2002, and they did sign an agreement with the state saying that if the state wants to denies Entergy a Certificate of Public Good, that they will shut the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they turned around and reneged on that. And they have been denied now, officially, as of Monday, their Certificate of Public Good, but they've gone to court to try and continue to operate. And we will see. The state of Vermont is also appealing the lower court decision that said that the legislature couldn't shut the plant. So we've got major lawsuits going on. It will go to the U.S. Supreme Court. There's no doubt about that. And but we don't know. You know, it's a corporate court, obviously. But the court would have to force the state to grant a certificate of public good.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, that's it's one thing to negate the action of a state. It's another thing to force a state to do something. And so this is going to be a very interesting court case.
So fundamentally, we have the state refusing to extend the license of Vermont Yankee through this certificate of public good. And these companies, Entergy and the others that own nuclear power plants, they essentially operate on a national basis and work pretty tightly with the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And going back to its forerunner, the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, wasn't the original charter of the AEC to promote nuclear power? And is that still in the mission statement of the NRC?
Well, it's not in the mission statement of the NRC, but they do seem to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're supposed to be regulating, but and they don't really go out and promote too much. But there are instances where commissioners have gone out and talked, you know, very positively, shall we say, about nuclear power plants and the wonders of atomic energy. But the original AEC, yes, it was supposed to both regulate and promote atomic power.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't work too well, as we know.
And what is the history? Have there been any other state-based denials of extensions or renewals of permits? And have they been successfully overridden at the federal level?
Well, it's interesting because there are little places where a state can conceivably have an impact. One is water permitting. The state of New Jersey demanded that the owners of the, I believe it's the Oyster Creek reactor, they have what's called a once-through cooling system. They pull water out of the bay and put it back in 39 degrees hotter or thereabouts. And the state finally said, you know, you can't do that. You have to build a cooling tower, which, you know, converts a lot of the heat to steam. And the utility said, well, this is an old reactor. We don't want to do that. So they cut a deal, and Oyster Creek has been allowed to operate another 7 years. Of course, after 7 years, the utility will probably go into court again and try and continue to operate. And because what we're seeing in Vermont, and this is a big part of it, is, you know, Entergy signed a sovereign agreement with the state of Vermont and now, of course, is reneging on it. They said, okay, we'll operate for 10 years, but if you don't want us to operate after that, we'll shut, and now it's 10 years. The state does want them to shut, and they won't do it. So we'll see what happens at Oyster Creek in a few years. But the state of New York also has the opportunity to force Indian Point to get water permits because they're dumping heat and radiation into the Hudson. And Indian Point could be forced to build cooling towers. We don't think Entergy would do that because of the economics, and that'll be an interesting dynamic.
And Harvey, what's the history of Vermont Yankee in terms of any operational anomalies or in other words, accidents or conditions that risked public safety?
Well, the anomaly is that it exists at all. But
yeah.
In reality, one amazing thing is that a while ago, I think it was in the last couple of years, there was a public hearing on possible leaks and pipes of Vermont Yankee, and the company was confronted about certain pipes, and the company, under oath, said that these pipes didn't exist, that they didn't have them there, and by God, they do exist, and they are leaking tritium. And nobody went to jail for that one. They also had a cooling tower that just plain old flat out fell down and collapsed, and it's on the cover of a new book, actually. And they have been leaking radioactive material into the ground and into the Connecticut River. So, and right now, they have a steam it's not exactly a steam generator, but they have a component in the plant which is causing them a serious problem in terms of their heat exchange, and they are at half power. And, you know, that's half too much for me, but nonetheless, it does indicate a serious problem as well. So things at Vermont Energy have not been great. It is a 40-year-old plant, and, you know, it's time to shut it down. There's no doubt. They want to shut. It's just, and the owner, the Entergy, you know, owns a bunch of nuclear plants. They're based in New Orleans, and they went around buying up cheap old reactors, you know, like buying up Model A's or something.
Well, Entergy and Exelon are the two biggest nuke operators in the country now, right?
Correct. And, you know, it's interesting how they choose names that sound like laxatives. Although that's sort of fitting in that today's New York Times is running a big piece about how these companies do not have enough money to shut their reactors down, to do the dismantling that, you know, they've told the public they would do. So these nuclear companies, they don't care. They're in it for the money. You know, if they can irradiate you and make an extra $10, they will, and they do. As a matter of fact, and so all this is coming to a head, I believe. Peter, I think we're at a major turning point. You and I have been talking about this technology a long time, and 2011 marked a major turning point in two ways. First of all, of course, Fukushima on March 11th, the worst disaster in human history, and you know, still going on. At least three explosions when we were told for 40 years that nuclear power plants couldn't explode. Massive radiation releases, much of it coming to the United States, certainly spreading throughout the Pacific Ocean. And so, really, Fukushima took Japan out of the nuclear game. I mean, Japan has been, it's not like the Soviet Union, Japan has been at the core of the nuclear power industry. They make the reactor pressure vessels, they own Hitachi, they own General Electric and Westinghouse, which did the first the basic designs for nuclear plants. And Japan was going to build many more reactors, and now will build no more. And in fact, there are 54 licensed reactors in Japan, and two, count them, two are operating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Fukushima is a huge deal in terms of the future of the industry. We can talk more about that. And secondly, 2011 really marked a time where renewables, solartopian technologies, wind, solar tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, all that stuff, really crossed over and became cheaper than nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
And you started to see in the financial journals, Bloomberg's, Fortune, the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, all these magazines now are saying essentially that if you're Donald Trump, God forbid, or some other buccaneer of industry and you don't care about anything except profit, you're going to invest in solar before you invest in nukes. And that really happened in 2011.
Yeah. Now, Harvey, coming back to Fukushima, one of the things that I found remarkable is on the weekend of this dismal anniversary, I was watching my local television station, which is owned by NBC. And NBC's broadcast operations are now half owned by General Electric and half by Comcast. But the residue or the history of NBC greenwashing its nuclear the nuclear activities of its parent company GE continued, and so there's this hour-long special about Fukushima, and they cover the earthquake, they cover the tsunami, they talk about the you know, way people had to be evacuated from the area. And in the course of an hour, they barely touched on the radioactive issues. They barely touched on the meltdown. They made a passing reference to it. But it was remarkable to me that you could observe this one-year anniversary and play down the central issue, which was not the natural disaster of the earthquake and tsunami, but the failure in safety preparation, and fundamental issues like not having power because, after all, we generate power there. We don't need a backup power system to man the pumps to keep the cooling systems working. And it's stunning to me that there was nothing in there about lessons learned or about the problems that we need to address so that we could presumably continue to operate nuclear power plants without the risks of Fukushima.
Well, weirdly enough, I was in Japan in 1976, and I wrote a lot about nuclear power, and including Fukushima. And everybody there knew and was talking about the fact that these reactors are built in earthquake zones subject to tsunamis. I mean, tsunami is a Japanese word, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And so in many ways, of course, you know, what happened to Fukushima was horrible, but it wasn't a surprise. And now, you know, everybody's in, well, the major industry, of course, is in denial, and you've got a bunch of people writing about how the radiation releases of Fukushima weren't all that significant. I mean, Tokyo is only 200 miles. You got a city of, what, 10 to 20 million people.
Yeah.
That got irradiated.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a benchmark, you know, in many ways, the modern controversy over atomic radiation and its health effects started in England in the 1950s when a doctor, a medical doctor named Alice Stewart, was researching childhood leukemia. And she, you know, did a major survey and included many, many factors and just happened to include X-ray in her survey. And she discovered, much to her surprise and amazement, that X-raying pregnant women doubles the chance of childhood leukemia. And you know, the suggestion clearly was, well, maybe we should be X-raying pregnant women. And the medical industry went completely nuts, and they assaulted her. And, you know, it only took them 30 years to finally concede that, well, maybe we shouldn't be X-raying pregnant women. Now, what you had in the release of Fukushima is probably a blanket X-ray, at least, you know, bottom line,
mm-hmm.
to tens of millions of people in Japan, including all the pregnant women. So if you want to have a benchmark to start talking about the impacts of the radiation releases of Fukushima, let's start with the reality that virtually every pregnant woman in the region was X-rayed against her will. And a double childhood leukemia rate is almost a given. And no one's talking about this. This happened in Three Mile Island. By the way, and you, I'm sure, remember this, Peter, that when the releases came from Three Mile Island, the industry came forward and they said, well, nobody's going to be harmed. This is, you know, this is the equivalent of a chest X-ray for all the people within an 11-mile radius. Well, yeah, how many pregnant women were X-rayed, and what's the doubled rate of the childhood leukemia among their offspring?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you start from there. Now, we know that radiation from Fukushima came to the United States within a week. And one of the great travesties of the whole situation was President Obama going on national television here and assuring the public that the radiation, if it ever got here, which he kind of indicated it wouldn't harm anybody. And while he was speaking, the radiation was arriving here, and it was, in fact, detected. It went all across the United States. It was discovered in milk. And Dr. Jeanette Sherman and Joe Mangano have issued a piece, which I've published at nukefree.org, which says that it's highly likely at least 12,000 Americans have been killed by radiation from Fukushima. And, you know, and it continues to come here. And I've also published a map showing where the radioactive water has spread through the Pacific,
mm-hmm.
Where radioactive debris from Fukushima has washed up on the shores of Hawaii and the West Coast.
And Harvey, this is one of the interesting, how can I put it, sanitization from this NBC television report. They spent a whole segment focused on this swath of debris that is moving across the Pacific Ocean. And they talk about it as a hazard to navigation. They talk about it as a mess, like all the plastic bags and the other garbage that's floating out there. But they didn't reference that it could be radioactive, and they made no effort to investigate that.
Well, it is radioactive, and if they investigated it, they'd horrify everybody. But the fact is that we have radioactive debris floating all over the Pacific Ocean now, and they're continuing to dump radioactive water into the ocean at Fukushima. God knows how much. And I mean, she's the only one who knows, actually. And you know, it's an apocalyptic event. It's dwarfed Chernobyl. We had four explosions, probably at least three, maybe four, at Fukushima. One of them may have been fission. You know, it was generally argued that they were hydrogen explosions, but according to Arne Gundersen, nuclear engineer, one of them looks suspiciously like, it could have been the equivalent of an atomic bomb, which the industry all these years has said is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is an interesting little story. At Three Mile Island, there was a hydrogen bubble, and everybody was afraid, I mean really afraid, that there was going to be a hydrogen explosion. And there wasn't, thankfully. And people went from questioning why the accident happened to wondering why it wasn't worse. And in the lead-up to the opening of Three Mile Island, which happened on December 28, 1978, exactly 3 months before the thing blew, there was a fight, strong public resistance to Three Mile Island Unit 2. And one of the people who opposed it made it her issue that Three Mile Island is in the flight path of the Harrisburg Airport. If you're ever flown into Harrisburg, you fly right over the reactor. And she said, well, this is crazy. At the very least, you have to strengthen the containment dome. And she fought, and she actually won. And so the Three Mile Island Unit 2 containment dome, because of this woman's efforts, was the strongest dome in the country. And it may well be, in retrospect, that the reason that the reactor didn't blow its lid is because this woman forced them to make it strong enough to withstand a jet crash.
Wow. What's her name? Do you remember?
No, I don't. I wish I did.
Yeah.
But that's a true story. And it's true all over the country now. In California, we have San Onofre is shut.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting because having problems with steam generator tubes. Now, steam generators have been around a long, long time. And they are part of the Westinghouse pressurized water design, which takes superheated radioactive water out of the core and runs it through a pool of so-called clean water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you create the steam that turns the turbine.
Right.
And the idea is that you protect the water, the generator water, from becoming radioactive.
Yeah, they're discrete systems.
Technically, what's happening now is that newly installed steam generator tubes are disintegrating.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting leaks out of the primary heat system into the secondary heat system, the heat exchange system. And it blows the whole design. Because, A, you can have serious problems within the reactor, and, B, you irradiate this water, which just turns the steam, which goes everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a major deal, and it seems to be generic. In other words, there are all the Westinghouse reactors, design reactors, around the country are susceptible to this. And if it's happening in new steam generators, what's going to happen to these old reactors? We have 104 reactors in this country. And sooner or later, they all need new steam. Well, half of them need new steam generators. And about half are the pressurized and half of the boiling water, which is the Fukushima design. So, if this turns out to be a generic problem, and right now there's an NRC team in San Onofre, and they're not giving a reopening date. Basically, they're saying the reactor, the Unit 3 there, is shut indefinitely until they can figure out what to do and figure out what the real problem is. If this is a generic problem affecting all these pressurized water reactors, then about half the 104 operating reactors, licensed reactors in this country are going to have to go down soon.
Now, Harvey, it appears that not only did the Obama administration fail to learn anything from Fukushima, but that it is captive to the industry. We know that Exelon is based in Illinois. Obama's top political advisor, David Axelrod, was a paid advisor to Exelon for some period of time before Obama was elected president. And what we've seen is the licensing for construction of two new nuclear generators along the Savannah River in Georgia, which is already the site of nuclear waste issues from the weapons plant that was sited there during the Cold War. So how do we square your enthusiasm and optimism about closing Vermont Yankee with the decision of the Obama administration to build two new reactors and to put up $8-point-something billion in federal subsidies, loan guarantees for the private companies that can't get Wall Street to back their risky investments?
Well, this is very interesting, Peter, and you heard it here first. I don't think those reactors will be finished, and I don't think there will be any more nuclear plants built in this country. You have four reactors technically more or less under construction right now, the two that you talked about in Georgia, and there's two in South Carolina next door. The main reason they're there is because the state law allows the utilities to force the ratepayers to pay for these plants as they're being built. It's a total scam. Even if they never go online, the ratepayers still have to pay. So it's just really offensive and very expensive. But, you know, what happens then is the utility is not on the hook for anything. They got federal loan guarantees, and they're forcing the ratepayers to pay. So they can just build, you know, to their heart's content. They actually make more money if the reactors never go online, and they won't. Now, there's still, you know, Obama gave this $8.33 billion to the Volcker project in Georgia, but there's still $10 billion left in the DOE, Department of Energy loan guarantee fund, and there's nobody lined up to get it. Nobody's set up to build a new nuke in this country. It may change soon, but in the meantime, this is the first year since the early days of the Bush administration that the executive branch has not asked for more money to be added to the loan guarantee program.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big deal. And, you know, we confronted this in 2007, the last full year of the Bush administration, well, the next last full year of George W. Bush, the industry went in for $50 billion in loan guarantees. And a national grassroots organization sprung up, and we started the nukefree.org website, brought petitions into Washington, and we killed it. We stopped them. And there's a huge deal. Since then, no money has been added to the nuke loan guarantee fund.
Mm-hmm.
And it stands at $10 billion, more or less, with the $8.33 gone out to Georgia. And nobody's put in a request yet, and we expect somebody to do so. But this industry is really way underwater. And as I said, solar is now much cheaper. And the only way they can build nuclear is to get the government to pay for it and the ratepayers.
Now, Harvey,
as you say, no private money is coming forward.
Right. On the loan guarantee question, I'm a little confused because I thought that Senator Kyle of Arizona had successfully deleted a bunch of green projects from an energy bill, I believe this was 2 years ago, and substituted $35 billion in new loan guarantees for nuclear construction.
No, it never went through.
Oh, it didn't. Okay.
Now, he may have done that in a draft of the bill,
mm-hmm.
But no, it hasn't gone through.
Okay.
And, you know, renewables are being harmed also by, you know, the fallout from the nuclear loan guarantee program, and loan guarantees are starting to become a bad word after Solyndra
right.
and all that. But the fact of the matter is that the industry is really, really stalled. In Europe as well, and now, of course, Japan.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Germany is on track to eliminate nuclear power plants over the next 20 years, right?
That's correct. In fact, Germany has just announced within the last month a $250 billion commitment to new renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a huge deal. And this is what should be done here in the United States. You know, Obama has come out and said he's going to put tariff taxes on solar being imported from China because everybody's complaining about China subsidizing their solar industry and undercutting the rest of the industry. Putting tariffs on is exactly the wrong thing to do. What the United States should be doing is matching the Chinese solar funding. And, you know, don't make them more expensive. Just make ours cost competitive with theirs. And if we put as much money into renewables as we put in the nuclear, we'd be fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harvey, I want to thank you for the update. Is there anything you'd like to add? And once again, your website is nukefree.org if people
right.
want to get more info.
Nukefree.org. What I do there is I post late-breaking news in renewables and in nuclear. And I also have a blog up there about what's happening in Vermont Yankee and the struggle to shut that. And I also have solartopia.org, where we talk about you know the coming solar age, which we're transitioning into very, very quickly. So.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great to be on with you, Peter. I'm glad you're still doing this. You're one of the great talk hosts in this country.
Well, Harvey, it's my pleasure, and thanks for joining me today.
Anytime.
Harvey Wasserman. And again, nukefree.org is where you can get more information. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you'll share this podcast with a friend.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.